and I see that the skills she developed to deflect the mean comments of her peers protected her from internalizing the type of nasty, critical voice I hear in most people. She is human, of course, and has days when she is unkind to herself. But I've never known anyone who can so easily move past self-critical moments to get back to her self-love. Practice forgiveness. Forgiveness is a crucial ingredient for living with self-love. We are human. We don't always do or say things correctly. We make what we consider mistakes and get ourselves into difficult situations. At the meditation retreat I mentioned earlier, I learned a simple yet powerful forgiveness meditation that has stayed with me ever since. If by deed, speech, or thought, foolishly I have done wrong, all forgive me, honored ones, who are in wisdom and compassion strong. I freely forgive anyone who may have hurt or injured me. I freely forgive myself. I recite these words regularly, as they gently remind me that even though my intentions stem from my heart, I may still foolishly blunder and create suffering for myself or other people. This meditation quiets the obsessive message swirling around in my brain, telling me I'm bad for making a mistake. And it reminds me that love is what ultimately matters. I am able to make amends when necessary, with others or myself, and turn my attention back to what is truly important in my life. Elizabeth, self-love in relationships. Self-love is one of the essential tools I give my clients to help them in relationships. When you are in a difficult moment in relationship with another person, it is helpful to remember that you are worthy of love, even when you have made what you think is a mistake. Even when you are so confused that you don't know how to repair the damage caused by your actions or words. In these moments, you have an opportunity to reach deeply into your heart and remember that you are capable of love. Remind yourself that you are willing to learn something new from the problems you and your partner are having. Stay open to finding out what the difficult moment is about. If you take the time to express what is true for each of you and speak directly from your hearts, you can work out your difficulties. And if your struggles are too monumental to overcome, your self-love will give you strength to go separate ways. When you collapse into self-loathing, thinking you're bad for whatever has caused the conflict, you have no resources to contribute to healing the situation. If you fall back on your self-love, though, you remember that even if it takes time to figure out the struggle, you are still a good person who is capable and worthy of love. You have the resources to patiently try to understand your partner's point of view and also figure out your own part in the struggle. Staying with self-love keeps you from withdrawing your love from your partner. You don't need to prove they are wrong in order to feel good about yourself. I teach my couples clients to focus on what they need to say to each other instead of being sidetracked with concern about their own worth and value as people. It's distracting to be preoccupied with, "I'm not good enough," or "I'm a bad person," in the middle of a communication issue. It's much more useful to focus on the conflict at hand rather than being in your own struggle about how you're inadequate. When you and your partner both cultivate the deep sense of worthiness that comes with self-love, you bring unlimited resources to your relationship, resources that are especially useful during the inevitable difficult moments. I was taught during my upbringing that being a hero was about doing big, brave deeds in the world. What I have learned as a mother and a partner is that love takes bravery. During the hard times, I must be fierce with myself to avoid collapsing into criticism. Self-love allows me to stay centered in my self-worth, forgive myself, and learn whatever lesson I am meant to learn. The courage this requires then expands my capacity to give and receive love. What a useful resource! Think about how deepening your self-love might help you in all types of relationships, with partners, friends, children, family, and work colleagues. Build your practice and see if it helps you become a better communicator. It is the warrior's path to reach for the equilibrium of self-love, rather than collapsing or attacking in relationships. I believe no pursuit is more important than this. Lynn Scott, Elizabeth's mom. I stopped hating my body in my 75th year. I'd made many attempts to love it, and I'd succeeded in the past, for brief times. I'd been a happy tomboy in the 1940s, beginning menses late and having no shape till almost college. I felt betrayed when all that began. College dorms were the dressing rooms for torture, brassieres and underarm pads, waist pinchers, long leg girdles and stockings that attached to either the girdles or a garter belt that hung below the waist with four pincher clips to hold them up. During the curse, as our mothers had called menstruation, we added silly, thin, elastic Kotex belts that had a back and front fastener with teeth that were supposed to hold the pad between our legs. In those days, we girlfriends didn't discuss anything that I have just written, and we never talked about what was happening to our bodies. This unnatural squelching of my development into young womanhood, added to by cryptic asides from my equally suppressed mother, "I know you would never do anything to hurt me, dear," the only sex education I received, lay the path to my alienation from my healthy body. I married, had four children, was divorced, and fell into the feminist second wave with abandonment. Yet I didn't feel like a woman. Amazing, huh? It was when I was 44 years old, at a speculum party, and saw all those vaginas, beautiful in their stages of life, just like mine. When I finally accepted that I was a woman, I had already abandoned the entrapments of half the undergarments of my early adult days, but shame still hung on my thighs. For a long time, I just covered it over. Certainly the women's community, with its focused music, talking circles, openness about love in all forms, gave us opportunities to carry our voices out against the Vietnam War, racism, civil rights. I found a platform to leap off into graduate school, a non-traditional counseling collective of bright men and women. We knew that power over anyone was the same old rift we'd been subjected to as women. By the time I was 56, I was once again alone after two serious attempts at marriage, one that gave me my children, and another with a woman. As I've said, there were periods of time, especially within my second relationship, where I accepted my body based on how much it was loved by my partner. However, the complex damage of my upbringing, and of hers, sent me fleeing after 10 years. I was a mother as well as a grandmother when my own mother died, and I inherited my 80-year-old father. My son, long a troubled boy and now a troubled man, was my focus too, between my 56th and 70th years. All my energy was turned outwards. I still founded women's organizations to support up-and-coming talented women, yet there was inner work to do. I attended Quaker meetings throughout my adult life, knew the value of meditation, and had an early connection with spirit. But I'd misplaced the power of that inward journey. The same year I lost a breast to cancer, I found Spirit Rock, a Buddhist meditation center, and a somatic experiencing counselor who wouldn't accept my talking head. She led me into the unknown realm of my body feelings. For years I had written everything I could about my family of origin, the good and the bad. But now I had learned to recognize that the dramas my mind delivered endlessly were separate, and quite irrelevant compared to the long-held feelings sitting heavily in my body. It has come to me at last that while suffering seems to be the name of the game on planet Earth, there are steps one can take to embrace it all. By not dodging or denying, by taking the time to be with myself at my core, by working on putting out loving kindness towards myself, as well as those within my circle and everything alive. I am quite content in this overweight, single-breasted body that seems to be far older than I am. I will give it the same love as it ages that I gave my father into his 90s. This is freedom and personal power at last. Sowing seeds of self-love. When I learn to love my body, I learn to love all that my body is capable of doing and enduring. I learn that this body will change and grow and age with me. It is mine to enjoy, adorn, love, protect, and present to the world. It is a gift inherited from my family, and it is my responsibility to love and cherish it. Jessica Diaz, the Body Positive Board Member. Self-love is not for sissies, said Elizabeth to a group of New Yorkers during a 2011 Body Positive workshop. She was right, and the participants in our workshop agreed. It is not an easy feat to have self-love in a world that pushes us to amplify our inadequacies. Just look at the magazine covers as you're standing in line at the grocery store, and calls us mean names when we say out loud that we love ourselves. It is much easier to blame our bodies, lives, or other people for our problems, and to release responsibility for our own contentment. Elizabeth and I view the work of cultivating self-love as one of the most important tasks people can undertake. Just as self-loathing and body dissatisfaction can color every aspect of your life, so can self-love. Choosing it is like committing to a loving relationship. There are rough patches, of course, but the rewards are endless. Living with self-love demands that you repeatedly dig deep inside to understand that you deserve to cherish yourself, just as you would cherish a partner, dear friend, or child. Your body does not have to be the cause of your suffering. You might try thinking of it as the amazing vehicle that allows you to move through this world, or a vessel to be filled with life's rich experiences. Each and every one of us has unique gifts to offer, which are meant to be shared. When we stop blaming our bodies for our struggles, we have an unlimited capacity to use our talents to make the world a better place, even in the smallest of ways. Cultivating self-love is like planting a garden. Both take time and effort, especially as you get started. Preparing your soil can be hard work, and planting seeds can be tiring. For some time, nothing happens. You have a plot of dirt that needs attention, but you don't see any results of your labor. Then, abruptly, little plants push their way through the ground and begin their journey towards the sun. Day by day, they get bigger, and soon you see flower buds begin to form. Your garden continues to require attention and care, but suddenly your flowers bloom, and you are rewarded with vibrant beauty and abundant joy. Your vegetable and fruit plants turn their flowers into food that sustains your life. So it is with self-love. It takes more time and attention in the beginning, but one day you wake up and realize that tending to your self-love garden has become part of your everyday life, and you blossom. You are rewarded with a bountiful crop, a balanced relationship with your body, freedom to pursue your dreams and purpose, a deepened connection to the people in your life, and more beauty surrounding you than you ever imagined possible. This analogy might not work for you. If this is the case, think about what you do like to do. Are you a musician? Do you practice your instrument regularly, knowing that when you first attempt to play a new song, it probably doesn't sound great? With time and practice, though, the song reveals itself through your instrument, and you experience the beauty of listening to the results of your creativity and hard work. Perhaps you like to do jigsaw or number puzzles. In the beginning, there is no order. With attention and patience, however, the pattern reveals itself and everything fits into place. As you do more puzzles, they become easier to solve, and you search out more challenging ones because your brain is rewarded when you find the solutions. If you are a dancer, you know the joy of practicing a physical movement repeatedly. Over time, you put many movements together and can perform an entire dance, bringing delight to both you and your audience. Think about what does feed your soul, and use it as inspiration to put the same attention, practice, patience, and care towards enhancing your self-love. I invite you to explore the ideas and practices in this chapter to find the tools that work best to help you to step towards self-love and away from self-criticism, even when those around you choose to partake in this fruitless ritual. Remember that loving yourself takes practice and courage. The more you use your gentle, compassionate voice, the faster your brain will recognize this new pattern and more easily respond with loving kindness instead of an attack from your nasty critic. Self-love is your ultimate protection. Body positive practices. 1. Giving yourself permission. As you cultivate self-love, you become aware of how you want to treat yourself and be treated by others. You also become more closely connected to your life purpose and the values by which you wish to live. It takes courage and the willingness to take risks to live from this place. The practice offered here is to help you give yourself permission to follow your heart. Instructions: sit or lie down in a comfortable position. Breathe in and out, and allow your body to become quieter with each breath. Notice any thoughts that are in your brain, and without judgment, allow them to pass through. From this quiet place, explore any sanctions or restrictions that block you from living fully, from expressing your true purpose, your creativity, your unique gifts. What is in the way of treating yourself kindly? Of being treated how you would like by others? These obstacles might come from outside sources, such as the parameters of your job, or the voice of someone who tells you how you should live your life. Or they may be inside your own mind, fears that block you from having the life experience you desire. Allow yourself as much time as you need to observe what comes up. When you're ready, get your journal or a piece of paper and write at the top of the page, "I give myself permission to." Now, without consciously thinking too much, write down everything that comes to mind. What do you want to give yourself permission to do? For example, "I give myself permission to notice my critical voice when it comes up and to explore why it's being mean to me." Or, "I give myself permission to express my creativity by signing up for a painting class." Some people feel that they're not ready to give themselves permission to do or have what they want. So they head their paper with, "I want to give myself permission to." Do this practice in whatever way feels most useful. Remember, this is for you only. So let yourself be free to write down even the most outlandish things. You'll know you're done when your hand stops writing and your brain feels still. Give yourself time to look over the list to see which items you want to take on first. These might be the easiest or the ones that ignite the most passion when you hear them. Make a new permission list whenever you find that you're stuck in a behavioral or attitudinal rut, need to make a big decision, or are giving yourself a hard time for one reason or another. It's a great way to gather information from your inner wisdom. 2. Moving from the critical voice to self-love. Your critical voice, though not very pleasant, offers an excellent opportunity for you to find out what you're afraid of, face your fear, and give yourself the gift of reaching for self-love. This practice takes you through a process of having a dialogue with your critical voice, followed by a meditation that will help you give yourself unconditional love. Note: I recommend not doing the work with your critical voice unless you have time to do the whole practice. Instructions: A. Talking with your critic. Think for a moment about how your critical voice has been speaking to you lately. It might sound like, "You're not," or "Why can't you?" or "I'm too," or "If only you'd," fill in the blank. The exact form it takes will be unique to your life experience. Write down the statement that comes to mind, or if there are many, one in particular that you'd like to work on right now. Now, have a dialogue with your critic to learn more about what it is afraid of and what it actually needs. Take time to think about and write your answers to the following questions. Don't overthink your responses. Let your inner critic speak honestly. Critical voice. If you are just fear talking, what are you afraid of? What do you need to feel less afraid? How would you feel if you got what you needed? For example, peaceful, confident, brave, relieved, competent, content, etc. Whatever it is that your critical voice is trying to attain, this is the internal resource you will want to reach for. Take time to think or write about what it would feel like to give yourself an abundance of this nourishing resource in this very moment. Can you take the risk to have more peace, confidence, in ways that don't include trying to change the size or shape of your body? B. Reaching for self-love. This part of the practice offers a meditation to explore what it feels like to move into a deep place of self-love. It is not a place of perfection you get to and stay, but a practice you cultivate that can be used as a response when your critical voice starts to speak. Do this meditation as often as necessary, and in whatever way works best for you, to remember that you can always reach for love. Alternatively, you can reach for the internal resource that came up in the preceding talking with your critic. Doing so will also enhance your experience of self-love because you're giving yourself what you need in the moment. Sit or lie down and close your eyes if you choose. Adjust your body to get as comfortable as possible. Feel the support of the beautiful, nourishing earth beneath you. Breathe deeply into your body and imagine every one of your cells now receiving the oxygen they need to thrive. Let your breath flow into all parts of your body, starting with your head and moving down to your toes. Observe the places where you are holding tension. You don't have to do anything except observe what is happening in your body in this moment. Remind yourself that you are a part of the whole of creation, and like every other living thing, you deserve to be nourished. Feel the rhythm of your breath going in and out, and allow yourself to sink into the supportive and generous earth. Now, use your imagination to create a safe space for you to enter here and now. Imagine that this space is filled with a never-ending abundance of unconditional love. In this loving space, all aspects of your body, soul, and spirit are cherished, including your perceived flaws and imperfections. You may visualize an actual physical place, or it may be one you make up in your imagination. Wherever it is, this place is here for you always. You may see it in your mind's eye, or it might just be a feeling of comfort and safety that you experience. Stay here as long as you'd like. Now, feel the shelter and warmth of the brilliant sky above you. The sky offers you the oxygen you breathe, the sunlight required for life on Earth, and asks nothing in return as it gives you its life-giving gifts. Allow this protective and tender love to envelop you. Feel yourself centered right here in the middle between the loving and generous Earth and the tender and protective sky. Here you are, perfectly made and lovingly cherished. This place is always here for you whenever you need to feel love for yourself. The natural world never judges, never criticizes, never excludes. It offers unconditional love in ample abundance. Its beauty is always available to show you your true reflection. Reach deeply into your heart and open to the love and compassion that are always waiting there, even when you forget. Find time as often as possible to connect with this loving space. Take a deep breath that once again reaches every cell in your body. When you're ready, come back to the room. Take some time to write about your experience, using the following questions to guide your exploration. Was I able to create a safe space in which I accessed unconditional love for myself? If not, what obstacles do I need to address to get to this place? Am I willing to take the time I need to reach deeply for the nourishing resource of self-love? What are specific things I can do on a regular basis to stay in touch with my self-love? C. Responding to your critic. In this last part of the practice, you will create a response to your critical voice. On the paper where you held your dialogue with your critic, write one statement about yourself that comes from the unconditional loving voice within you. If you can't access this voice, just pretend there is a person who loves you unconditionally. What would they say about you? Keep this statement with you as a reminder of your truth. Instructions for group practice. Doing this practice in a safe group setting is extremely powerful. We all have critical voices, so exploring them together and examining how they affect our relationships with one another is quite an experience. The instructions are still divided up into three parts, noting when to go back to the individual practice directions for reference. A. Talking with your critic. Sit in a circle. Make sure everyone has a half sheet of blank paper and a pen. Do the first part of the practice the same way as if you're doing it individually, as described before, and have each person write down their critical voice's statement. Now, however, you will all crumple up your pages and throw them into the center of the circle. Mix them up before each person takes one and unfolds it. The next step is for everyone to get up together and walk around in the middle of the circle, reading the critical statements out loud, over and over again. This is an anonymous activity, so even if you get your own, you don't have to say it's yours. After several minutes, someone can be a timekeeper. Everyone stops moving and reading. As a group, call out your responses to the following questions, read by one person in your group. How do you feel in your body right now? What physical sensations do you notice? How do you feel in relation to the other people in the room? Connected? Disconnected? Again, take time to let everyone respond. Go back to your seats and designate one person to go around the room with a recycling bin to collect the crumpled papers with the critical voices written down. Another option is to burn or bury them as a group after you're done with the entire practice. Have a discussion about what this experience felt like. What did it feel like to hear all of the voices at once, out loud? How does it make us feel to know everyone has a critical voice? More compassionate towards others? Towards ourselves? How do we think having these critical voices running gets in the way of our communication with other people? Everyone will now do the individual writing activity with their own critical voice. Take about 10 minutes for this exploration. As a whole group, or in pairs if your group is large and time is limited, have each person share what they learned about their critical voice, its fears, and the inner resource they really need that their critical voice is trying to get for them, though in a misguided way. How can we support one another in taking action to have more of these vital, nourishing resources in our lives? B. Reaching for self-love. Do the meditation as in the preceding individual practice. C. Responding to your critic. Have everyone write down a statement from their unconditionally loving voice inside, as in the talking with your critic individual practice. Then, go around the circle and let each person read their statement out loud. Be mindful that this can trigger fears of being labeled conceited or arrogant. So agree in advance that no one will think of others in this way, and that everyone has the right to say kind things about themselves out loud. Have a group discussion about the experience. What did it feel like to hear everyone make positive statements about themselves? How did it feel to read our own? How would our lives be different if we were free to express positive feelings about ourselves from a place of self-love, knowing it's not the same as conceit? 3. Love letter. This simple practice is offered to help you see yourself through eyes of love. You're going to write a love letter to yourself. Some people like to write to an oft-criticized body part, or their whole body if it's the target, first apologizing for criticizing it, and then giving it gratitude for all it does each day. The body part can then have its say, expressing whatever comes up. Other people prefer to write a freestyle letter, allowing their unconditionally loving voice to speak. You might want to write an ode to yourself. Just remember to pick the form of writing that gives you the most joy. If you're struggling to find loving things to say to yourself, imagine that someone who loves you unconditionally is writing the letter, and let them speak. Consider putting your letter in a self-addressed envelope and giving it to someone with instructions to mail it at a random moment in the future. Or tuck it in a drawer where you'll run across it from time to time. Write lots and lots of these letters to yourself. It's not an act of conceit. It's true self-care. 4. Loving touch. Physical affection is one of the ways we remind our close friends and family we love them. It may sound silly, but touching yourself with the same care and affection can strengthen your relationship with your body, and feels nice too. Try petting your elbows or knees like you would a cat, or giving various body parts a tap and a personal hello once in a while. You can stroke your own hair like you would the hair of a loved one, or even nuzzle your own shoulders with your cheek. Massaging your tense spots is a great idea too, as are self-hugs. These gentle touches can be quick, easy ways to remind you how wonderful it is to have a body, and thank it for being there for you. Competency 4. Declare your own authentic beauty. Goals. Experience beauty as a creative, dynamic process. Inhabit your unique body with joy and confidence. Benefit. Expand your imagination to behold authentic beauty in yourself and others. It seems so obvious that if we really appreciated what a gift it is to be alive in our bodies, and how amazingly complex and intricate these bodies are, we wouldn't be able to hate ourselves so well. We would recognize our own beauty not in an arrogant way, but simply as part of the beauty in this amazing world. Just imagine if all the talent in advertising that went into convincing us that we aren't good enough could be freed for true creative work. J. Ruth Gendler, Notes on the Need for Beauty. Beauty. It surrounds us in every moment. To me, beauty is the sight of my beloved mother and daughter baking bread together while deep in conversation. It is in the color and fragrance of flowering fruit trees bursting to life in spring. It is my strong, fleshy thighs that carry me easily up imposing granite peaks. I experience beauty in the hug and kind words from a dear friend when I am in pain. It is the light that fills the room at workshops when people recognize their own magnificence. The fourth competency of the Be Body Positive model, Declare Your Own Authentic Beauty, addresses the obstacles to seeing your own beauty and invites you to actively participate in experiencing the exquisiteness of our world. There is beauty everywhere, and we are all part of it. We declare our authentic beauty by choosing to see and express ourselves just as we are, internal and external qualities combined. Exploring beauty through a body positive lens teaches us to have a dynamic, engaged relationship with the world around us. We honor our bodies as we pass through each developmental stage of life, which leads to true self-care, because we don't confuse it with a desire to transform our physical selves to meet someone else's definition of beauty. When we are blind to our authentic beauty, we are more susceptible to harmful societal messages that promote insecurity and doubt. And, as we know, the behaviors that go along with attempts to fundamentally change our bodies can lead us to worse health over time. Seeing our beauty is not an exercise in vanity. It is a necessary component of good physical and emotional health. My mom uses her morning shower time to thank her body and tell it how wonderful it is. She washes herself with a tender, loving touch, as if she is the child she once was, being bathed by the person who dearly loved and respected her. She is 86 years old and one of the healthiest, happiest people I know. Her beauty is more radiant every time I see her. Sarah Lewin, Body Positive Leader. Sometimes I wonder if our cultural obsession with unattainable beauty ideals is a way to make things in life simpler, a sort of cultural defense mechanism. It would be so much simpler if life were only about having the right type of hair, the perfect nose, or the best-fitting jeans. Experiencing beauty in our flaws and strengths, in our ability to control some things and not control others, is a much bigger challenge. Finding beauty in aging, growing, and in being different means beauty is no longer something static we try to attain, but rather a part of our lived, changing experience. For most of my life, my understanding of beauty, simply put, was a one-dimensional snapshot of someone that was definitely not me. Through a series of moments and relationships, however, my world became broader and less controlled, enabling me to challenge the distorted lens through which my vision was filtered. One of the most influential of those was my time spent learning and laughing with the women I met at the Body Positive, who were living so fully and with so much love that I decided to move across the country to stay near them. These women provided me with the first community where I could experience myself authentically, and where my joy, humor, and fears were not silenced, but heard. Within this group, I could be entirely myself. My body's story, filled with complexity and contradictions, freckles and curls, was honored and celebrated. I now see, or rather work on seeing, my beauty in motion. It's not the picture of me mid-laugh, but the actual experience of my laughter. It is me hunched over, my abdominal muscles clenching to the point of pain because I cannot control my giggles. My beauty is visceral. It is in my movements through life. It's my boldness to experience hardship and fear, power and insecurity, kindness and love. Obstacles to seeing and expressing our authentic beauty. When we are awake and paying attention, we see beauty everywhere, in nature, art, in other people. So why is it, when it comes to seeing our own, so many of us suddenly become blind? From the one-dimensional ideal look created by corporate America, to appearance-based criticism and other formidable social sanctions related to image that begin in childhood and carry over into adulthood, myriad obstacles stand in the way of the beauty that is our birthright. To know true freedom, we must identify and deconstruct any hurtful messages we have received. We must understand how certain experiences may have contributed to the development of an internalized critical voice that perpetuates belief in our ugliness. Beauty as a social construct. Beauty ideals are social constructs, not truth. They only become truth when given that power. One of the ways this happens is if we believe other people have the right to define beauty for us. If we forget that the industries and individuals supplying the imagery profit greatly from excluding us, then we are more susceptible, both consciously and unconsciously, to internalizing their messages and purchasing their products and services. We can't deny that the glut of beauty images we absorb daily has a profound effect on our self-image. Psychologist and author Susie Orbach discusses the power of this imagery on our self-perception in her book Bodies. She points out the speed with which adults unconsciously process and match facial expressions and how this influences our reactions to the imagery we see. If we now apply this finding to images which are purposefully coded to be emotionally powerful by evoking mood, solution, aspiration, we realize the inevitability of our almost instantaneous reaction to the torrent of daily and hourly images around us. Many of these images are far from benign. Their purpose is invidious. They are brought to us by the merchants of body hatred. Looking back through history, we can determine that societal ideal beauty standards, which have changed over time, tend to leave out the majority of the population. These days, to make matters worse, the images we are bombarded with often show bodies as fragmented parts. We see perfect, perfectly photoshopped, sections of bodies. Rarely do we see whole people. When we do, they are frequently presented in highly sexualized poses, often with the women displayed in postures submissive to men. Absorbing these images day after day can cause us to become fragmented in our own bodies. Our definition of beauty will then incorporate toned asses, round perky breasts, well-developed six-packs, massive pectoral muscles, jutting hip bones, disconnected parts, to the exclusion of other qualities. People cut themselves into pieces all the time. It's difficult to have a conversation about bodies without hearing comments such as, "My legs are okay, but I hate my stomach. I like my hair, but my legs are too fat. All I want is to have a flat, well-toned stomach. I wish I had bigger muscles in my arms. My arms are too big." On and on the chopping goes, setting people up to continually compare their bodies with those of others, and with the imagery fed to us by the corporations that are after our money. "I want her legs. I want his abs. I want that model's perfect skin. I want anything other than myself," is what I hear in these statements. I desire perfection. Perfection in this case being a computer-enhanced static image. No matter how much we improve ourselves, though, we can't replicate the perfect people we see in advertising. People who have had every possible flaw removed by a Photoshop professional. Even models cannot live up to the images that have been created in their likeness, even after hours of having their hair, makeup, and clothes worked on by stylists. Necks are stretched, dark skin is lightened, waists and thighs are trimmed, breasts are enhanced, abs are better defined. The people who manipulate photos have the final say in defining human perfection. They generate images that no one can recreate in real life, even if they undergo every cosmetic surgery procedure in the world. We are all flawed then, because we are living, breathing human beings who can't match the fantasy of the computer technicians. Even people who spend excessive time and money attempting to achieve the ideal body will continue to age. Their bodies will naturally break down, and any fleeting moment of perceived perfection will be gone. No amount of weight loss or cosmetic surgery will stop any of us from dying, and they may even contribute to our early demise, as was the case with my sister Stephanie. What people look like to the outside world may not have any influence on their self-perception. Author Naomi Wolf writes of the thousands of diverse readers of her book, The Beauty Myth, who expressed their pain to her because they could not see beauty in themselves. There was no common thread that united these women in terms of their appearance. Women both young and old told me about the fear of aging. Slim women and heavy ones spoke of the suffering caused by trying to meet the demands of the thin ideal. Black, brown, and white women who looked like fashion models, admitted to knowing from the time they could first consciously think that the ideal was someone tall, thin, white, and blonde. A face without pores, asymmetry, or flaws, someone wholly perfect, and someone whom they felt, in one way or another, they were not. Poor self-image is not limited to any particular group of people. In the well-expressed words of Amanda Kessner, who shares her personal story later, "The way we experience our own body image and relate to representations of various bodies differs depending on our social location. Where are we coming from? What is our gender, our sexuality, class background, ability, cultural heritage. All of these variables affect body image. With the proliferation of advertisements promoting an ideal look for males as well as females, a rapidly growing number of boys and men also desire to transform their bodies. Some wish to look like the hyper-muscular men in the movies on TV and plastered all over men's health magazines. But many desire to emulate the emerging styles presented by ultra-skinny male celebrities and models. In one study, 80% of both men and women expressed a desire to change their weight. But half of the men wanted to gain, while the other half wanted to lose, but still be lean and muscular. A 2007 Columbia University study found that gay and bisexual men are at higher risk for developing eating disorders than heterosexual men. Recent research shows that males constitute 25% of people who suffer from anorexia and bulimia, and 40% of those with binge eating disorder. It is also important to note that most commonly used assessments to identify eating disorders are biased towards females, and that boys and men do not seek treatment for a number of reasons, including the perceived stigma of having a women's problem. I met a young man at a lecture I gave many years ago who was a compulsive over-exerciser. He stood up during the discussion section of my talk to share his distress at his inability to stop working out, even though he was desperate to do so. He had well-toned, large muscles and not an ounce of body fat. He said, "I know I'm not suffering as much as a girl with anorexia, but I just don't know what to do. I can't stop exercising. I've even turned my dorm room upstairs into a gym. What should I do?" I responded by first telling him I didn't believe in a hierarchy of suffering, that his pain was just as real as anyone else's. We talked for a while with the whole group, and then I asked him to speak to me after the session. He told me in private that he had been, in his words, a chubby adolescent, and described an experience he'd had in middle school that sent him diving headlong into an exercise compulsion. A friend said his girlfriend only liked him because she felt sorry for him since he was fat. Immediately, the boy began dieting and compulsively exercising, and 3 years later was unable to perceive his true reflection in the mirror. He said, "I know I'm probably crazy, but really, I only see fat when I look in the mirror." As he spoke, he was pulling at the part of his shirt that covered his belly. I described body dysmorphia to him, a disorder where people actually cannot perceive the size of their bodies. I told him this had been my experience, too, when I was his age and struggling with my eating disorder. I'll never forget the end of our conversation. Similar to what babies do when they move through an emotional experience, the boy took several shallow intakes of breath, followed by a prolonged exhale. With barely contained tears, he said, "What you've told me tonight has made all the difference in my life. Thank you." Amanda Kessner, the Body Positive's Outreach Coordinator. When I think of myself as a closeted young person, I wonder how my experience would have been different if I had been taught that not everyone is heterosexual, and how I would have felt differently had there been positive representations of queer people and queer women around me. I remember reading about lesbian experience in a women's studies textbook my sophomore year of college, and I remember feeling incredible relief. This is real, I thought. Growing up, it would have been empowering to see myself represented in a positive way. As a queer woman, these positive representations are still few and far between. In a world that places so much importance on visibility and aesthetics, I struggle with both my near absence in the social imaginary and also the blatant misrepresentation of my experience when visible. I'm not just interested in seeing a stock image of a lesbian woman. I need to see greater representation of the diversity of queer people. I may see images of women that I can, more or less, relate to, but their assumed heterosexuality is always present. The woman is next to a boyfriend or husband, wearing a wedding ring, subtly communicating that we are not alike. Part of my healing has been realized with other queer people who know how invalidating it is to be left out of the picture, and with allies who understand how this might feel. I find that having unconditional love for myself feels best. Seeing and honoring what I am feels true. Julian Juarez, Body Positive Leader. I am who I am, a Latino transgender man. Let me start off by saying that every transgender person has a completely unique story, so mine is as unique as everyone else's. My relationship with my body has been a journey because I have experienced both a female body and now a male body. I did not always know that this was who I was going to become, but deep inside, I knew there was something different about me. As a female, it took about 20 years to feel comfortable with my body and love myself for who I was, just me, loud, fat, and proud. My transition to becoming a man began in college when I learned about the transgender identity. I felt deeply excited and happy that I had found myself once more. Some people express the dilemma of, if you love yourself now, why do you have to change yourself? My response was, yes, I love myself, but for me, this transition is going to change my life, spirit, and soul into my true self. It was not going to alter my love for myself, just change my body to feel more like me. Since beginning my transition, I have not looked back. I am very happy with my decision. I could not wait to get pecs with my new body and stroll down the street topless, but that has not happened yet due to my scars. On one hand, I don't go topless for my safety. Many transgender people get killed every year just because of who they are. On the other hand, I feel self-conscious and fear being judged. I never thought I would have to go through my insecurities once more, but I am, now as a man. One thing I learned through the Body Positive Leadership Training is how to manage my negative inner voice. How I have to come to terms with my critic is by recognizing that the judgment is me judging myself, because I can't know what other people are thinking. Every day, I become a bit braver by not believing my inner critical voice. I have also become intuitive with my eating habits and worry more about my health than my actual body image. If I want pecs, with safe exercise, they will come, or not, and that is all good. Life is definitely a journey that I am still living through, and every day is a new challenge. I live with a positive outlook because every minute that I am alive, I know I can get to know myself more and love myself again and again. Deconstructing beauty ideals and imagery is a necessary task if we wish to expand our imagination enough to behold beauty in ourselves as well as in others. If we wait for magazine editors or advertisers to tell us our particular appearance or lifestyle have suddenly become supreme, we will be lost forever. If we rely on these sources to be our mirrors, we will never see our true reflection. We do not need to turn off the TV forever or never again look at a magazine, but we must stay conscious when we are in the presence of imagery and messages intended to reinforce the unkind voices of our internalized critics. We must hoist up protective shields of self-love in these situations, and remember that beauty is so much more than what we are fed by industries that profit from our insecurity. Social sanctions that obstruct our beauty. When we are young, powerful social forces exist that make it difficult, sometimes seemingly impossible, to resist viewing ourselves in a negative light. Many of us do whatever it takes to fit in, but we lose a part of ourselves in the process. We lose life force. Appearance-based bullying. Bullying in the form of physical and/or verbal abuse based on a person's clothing, weight, or other aspects of appearance has been around for a very long time. It has, however, escalated with proliferation of social media platforms that allow for anonymous, public humiliation. A 2013 survey done by www.ditchthelabel.org found that 60.2% of the respondents who experienced bullying were targeted for their appearance. These attacks can lead to self-loathing for being different or wrong, cause social isolation, and affect a person's psychological well-being. There is a growing concern among mental health professionals that aggressive forms of appearance-based bullying cause depression, anxiety, eating and exercise disorders, cutting, suicidal ideation, and other problems in young people with low self-esteem, and can even negatively affect those who generally feel good about themselves. One of the great benefits of peer-led body positive groups, especially on middle and high school campuses, is that they provide safe environments that break the isolation in which so many people suffer over.